You're listening to podcasts from the Congressional Internet Caucus Advisory Committee, www.netcaucus.org.
Okay, thanks everyone. We're going to get started. We know we're the last panel of the day, so we're going to keep this very fast-paced and interesting. This is the panel discussion on the two edges of global internet freedom sword. Can internet technologies promote free expression without enabling oppression? And it's also the third annual Judith Krug Memorial Intellectual Freedom Panel, and that's definitely going to be a topic that we're discussing today. We have a great panel here that I'm going to briefly introduce. We're going to set the stage with some of the things that are happening out there on some of these issues about internet freedom as it specifically relates to technology. I think this will be a great follow-on to the discussion we just heard about intermediaries and liability issues. And then we're going to start talking about solutions and engage with you as the audience. So very briefly, starting on the far right is Scott Busby. And Scott currently serves as the director for the Office of Multilateral and Global Affairs in the Bureau of Democracy, Rights, and Labor, where he oversees the Bureau's work in multilateral fora, internet freedom, business and human rights, the vetting of U.S. assistance for human rights concerns, and the protection of vulnerable groups. In the middle, we have Cynthia Wong, who is an attorney at the Center for Democracy and Technology and also the director of CDT's Project on Global Internet Freedom. And then to my immediate right, we have Peter Swire, who is the C. William O'Neill Professor of Law at the Moritz College of Law at The Ohio State University and also a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress and the Future of Privacy Forum. So today we're going to talk about this issue of technology and internet freedom from a variety of perspectives. And I think one thing that has struck all of us is the breadth of the types of issues that can arise. And it can be everything from very specific issues of technology, such as encryption or surveillance, things like that. It can be broad discussions about internet governance and the architecture of the internet. And it also can be how the legal framework can also be used as a double-edged sword. So whether it's libel law or surveillance laws, all of these things can be used both for positive social good as well as for oppression. So we're going to start with Scott, and he's going to give us the view from kind of the front lines of the State Department as they're dealing with these issues around the globe. Scott, thanks.
Thanks, Jeff. Pleasure to be here. Let me begin by making a point that my boss, Mike Posner, made this morning and Vince Cerf made more articulately in an op-ed in the New York Times a few weeks ago. And that point is, let's not fetishize the technology. I mean, the question here for this panel is, can internet technologies promote free expression without enabling oppression? It's not the technologies that are doing the work here, it's the people using the technologies. So let's be clear about the fact that the internet is but a new tool that will allow the exercise of long-standing rights. And I think it's important that we put people at the center of any debate that we have about how this technology is used. Because the internet and related technologies are independent of their users, I do think it necessarily makes the use of those technologies subject to abuse. So while the internet makes possible connections, forms of free expression, that may not have been possible in the past. It doesn't involve the costs that newspaper publication, TV, telephone necessarily entail. It also does mean that the operators of these systems necessarily are going to have access to some of those communications. And if those operators intend evil, then obviously they can do bad things to the users who are exercising their rights in this space. So I don't think we can eliminate the possibility of oppression through the use of these new technologies, but I do think we can maximize the good, try to maximize the good, and minimize the bad. Well, how are we in the State Department, and in particular the Bureau of Democracy, Rights, and Labor trying to do this? First, the U.S. government as a whole, consistent with what President Obama has said many times, we recognize the importance of walking the walk when it comes to internet freedom. We can't only be rhetorical supporters of internet freedom. We need to live these values in our own domestic practice. We're trying to do that. Again, our agency is not responsible for the governance of the internet domestically. Others are. Nonetheless, those domestic agencies do all that they can to ensure that the internet remains a free and open platform that can be used by all. In the context of debates around intellectual property protection and law enforcement, whether it's against criminals or terrorists, clearly there are competing equities. And one of our challenges as an administration, I think, is to balance the equities between these competing priorities. I think, the debates have been intense, and at times it has taken the administration longer to reach a position than some of us might have liked. I'm thinking here of SOPA and PIPA in particular. But in the end, the administration over the weekend did come out with a position that I think recognizes the fundamental ways in which these two proposed pieces of legislation could negatively impact our efforts to promote internet freedom, both at home and abroad. Similarly, there's lots of pressure to provide law enforcement with greater access to the variety of tools and networks involving the internet and related technologies. There are clearly some legitimate law enforcement purposes in terms of giving them access to these tools, but at the same time, those legitimate purposes need to be weighed against the legitimate purposes of free expression, free association, free assembly, which the internet allows us to realize. So my colleague John Tighe here in the front row and I are regularly engaged in intense interagency debates where we recognize the importance of trying to reconcile what we're doing domestically on these issues with what we're advocating internationally. Another way in which we're trying to advance our internet freedom goals is through diplomacy. Some of it's quite traditional diplomacy, bilateral with countries where there are internet problems, whether it's Vietnam, China, Egypt, Syria, Iran notably, Thailand. We have spoken out quite forcefully and clearly, publicly, about the problems in those countries when it comes to the internet, and we have raised our concerns privately with those governments, and we will continue to do so. Most recently, for those of you who didn't see, our spokesperson, Victoria Nuland, issued a quite sharp statement about the crackdown in Iran in terms of requiring internet cafes to put surveillance technology in their premises. And on the multilateral front, we are also very engaged. There have been discussions, activities in the OECD, the UN, including the Human Rights Council, the OSCE, and other multilateral bodies where we have very forcefully sought to promote the principles of internet freedom and decry efforts to restrict access to or operations on the internet. We will continue this effort. There will be a panel on the UN Human Rights Council in March on these issues where they will be debated And we will, following that panel, consider whether or not it makes sense to have the Human Rights Council act in some formal way on these issues. In addition to these places where we're taking positions in favor of internet freedom, we also have remained very strongly committed to a multi-stakeholder approach. We are against those governments who advocate for more government control of the internet. South Africa, Brazil, India in particular have allied themselves with this approach, as have the Russians and Chinese. And we have quite forcefully said, no, the internet has evolved in a successful way, we believe, through a multi-stakeholder model, and we intend to remain adherents of that model. But I do think there will be challenges as these debates on internet governance continue, convincing all member states of the UN that is in their interest not to have a governmental model of control, but rather this alternative hybrid multi-stakeholder approach, because the countries of the South in particular are quite accustomed to the notion that the more power they can have as governments over any given field, the greater the benefits to them are. And I think it is incumbent on us to demonstrate to them why the multi-stakeholder approach is in their interest. In addition to our diplomacy, we have a variety of programs we are supporting. We've committed $70 million to date to the Internet Freedom Cause. We'll probably commit another $25 to $30 million this year to a range of grantees doing everything from circumvention work to encryption to protection. There's the very famous panic button, which Tech Active, has put Mobile Active has put onto a variety of activist phone, which allow us to allow users to erase information if they are arrested by police. And we're doing a variety of training as well to ensure that users, both activists as well as average netizens, know what they have to do to protect themselves. The last area where clearly work needs to be done, which we're focused on, is the private sector. Of course, there's lots of interest in ways of compelling the private sector to behave better in this space, including sanctions, export controls, and our experience to date has been that while these are sometimes useful tools, they are very tough to apply in practice. Indeed, to date, for instance, the sanctions put in place through the CISADA legislation involving Iran have not been applied once yet to private companies because of the complexity of doing so. These technologies have dual uses, proving whether or not a company like Blue Coat, for instance, which has been much in the news, knew that its technology was actually being used in Syria is a tough thing to do. So we are urging the private sector as much as is possible to act proactively on these issues, to on its own adopt standards, promote behaviors, share information about the impact of their work on human rights in the countries in which they're operating. We feel that such voluntary, proactive behavior ultimately is going to ensure better outcomes than a fully compulsory regime. But that said, we are carefully looking at both approaches to try and ensure that companies are doing their best to promote human rights in the places they're doing business. Why don't I leave it there? Happy to take questions later on.
Okay. Thanks, Scott. So Cynthia, what do you see? You're very involved in internet freedoms on a global level, and what concerns you, and do you see any progress being made in that?
Sure. Well, I think, as you say, Jeff, threats to internet freedom can come in many forms, and I think I'll focus my remarks mostly on the threats that come in the form of policy and law and also in internet governance, in the internet governance field. And I think in talking through how to address these threats, it's often useful to go back to remember where we or how we got here to begin with. And internet freedom, at least as we've known it here in the U.S., didn't happen by accident. It was actually brought about by a specific set of policies and decisions about law and governance that were made early in the internet's days. What do I mean by this? And this is not an exhaustive list, but it's things like not placing duties on internet intermediaries to police the behavior of users so that platforms for user speech can flourish. It's things like not imposing technology design mandates on innovators, even if you have very good reasons, but instead letting innovators do what they do best. It's things like emphasizing user control and user empowerment when it comes to addressing offensive content online as an alternative, a lesser restrictive alternative to a more top-down content control regime. And finally, it's things like supporting a bottom-up, decentralized, and multi-stakeholder approach to internet governance that we've talked about already, so that these fast-changing technologies can be managed in a way that is scalable and flexible. And it's really this enabling framework that has allowed the U.S. to lead with our internet industry all around the world and allowed the internet to become an engine for economic growth that it is. And it's this framework also that has enabled the internet to promote human rights, to advance human rights. Freedom of Expression Association Assembly, as Assistant Secretary Posner alluded to this morning, which were all instrumental in supporting the Arab Spring social movement. But while today's internet is an engine for economic growth and for social movements, it's not guaranteed to be this way forever. And in fact, the internet, the free internet, can be jeopardized by regulation, even well-meaning regulation, if that regulation undermines the enabling policy framework for a free internet. At the same time, I want to fully acknowledge that the policy challenges that governments are now facing are very real and very challenging. Think about protecting national security in the age of WikiLeaks, about addressing cybercrime and protecting intellectual property on a borderless medium. It's all very complicated. There are no easy answers here. But how governments decide to address these very real problems will determine what kind of internet we will have in the future and what kind of internet the next 5 billion users who are now coming online in South America, in Asia, and Africa will be able to use. And in recent years, some countries have certainly moved away from the original enabling framework for the free internet. China, of course, has continued to engage in practices that conflict with an open internet, everything from DNS filtering to new registration requirements for users of social media. And, you know, China really doesn't show any signs of ceasing this kind of behavior if it's clamped on the internet, but unfortunately we're also seeing other countries beginning to follow in China's footsteps. And I'll just give a few examples here. Thailand has used a combination of intermediary liability, insult laws, and very vague cybercrime laws as a way to control content online in a way that tends to chill expression on the Thai internet. And then last week, a high court in India stated that Google, Facebook, and other social media sites could risk being blocked if they don't take more proactive steps to police offensive content on their sites. And in fact, I believe now the companies are facing criminal charges for some of the content posted by users in that country. India is also one of a number of different governments in the Middle East and in Asia that have placed increasing pressures on service providers to set up servers locally so that they can better enable surveillance and lawful intercept of user communication. And finally, countries like Russia and China and others are pushing for a more top-down regulatory approach to internet governance at places like the International Telecommunications Union, which could have serious consequences for internet freedom. So I think really to promote internet freedom, the U.S. government and all of us really need to push back against these developments that tend to undermine the enabling framework for free internet, even when those governments are our friends and our allies, and even when they are, maybe it's not particularly politically expedient, but I think that we do need to push back against these developments and push back most both in economic terms and on the human rights norms. I think what might not be as obvious from what is reported in the news is that often many of these countries are actually looking to us, to the U.S., for models for how to address complex policy challenges in ways that still enable internet freedom and internet openness. And anecdotally, I'll say that when I go abroad, I often get approached by activists and advocates and asked about very specific details and nuances about U.S. policy debates, which always surprises me. But it just goes to show you that people are really following what goes on here because they know that their own governments are also following what goes on here. And I can't tell you how many questions I've actually answered about SOPA and PIPA in the past 9 months traveling around the world. And so that's all just to say that what we do here in the U.S. really does set the example, just as China presents a countermodel or a counterexample that other governments could follow as well. So I think this trend just underscores the need for us to lead by example, and I think that as we debate these key policy challenges, both at this conference and the rest of the year, I think we really need to think about how we can show that we can both protect national security, protect intellectual property, and deal with these complex policy challenges while also promoting human rights and the open internet.
Thank you, Cynthia. So, Peter, you've done some writing and thinking about encryption, which I think raises both very interesting international issues, as Cynthia mentioned, as well as the issue of walking the walk at home. So maybe you could talk about that.
Well, thanks, Jeff. There's a lot of agreement on this panel. One of the things we notice is that this is complicated stuff. Most of us are in favor of stopping criminals and keeping national security safe and stopping piracy. And then we also want openness. And so there is some need to go into the details to figure out how to do those things. And each of us in our own ways has been trying to figure out how to do those. I'm going to lean to the side of openness and not bring out my law enforcement background so much today and try to explain, why in three areas. One is on encryption globally. The second is on CALEA, something that I talk about is going dark, whether the FBI is going dark. And the third is some of the themes of open internet. So on encryption, encryption was the big internet freedom issue of the 1990s. There were conferences, there were demonstrations, it was a great big deal, because at that time you could not ship your strong encryption from the United States to the rest of the world without going through an export control regime that stopped you from doing that. And after a huge battle, and there's a wonderful book by Mr. Levy called Crypto that tells the history, the United States changed that in 1999. I was part of the government process at that point, and what we said instead is you can go global on encryption. You can have strong encryption, which means if you're a human rights activist overseas, you can get the strong crypto built in the United States. You can communicate securely to the United States and the rest of the world, and the governments really won't be able to see into those packets because you're going to use good encryption. And that really was a transformation. It was a huge win. I have a paper with my co-author, Kanisa Ahmad, who's here, that's online now, called Encryption and Globalization, which talks about how India and China are trying to repeat the mistakes from the 1990s. India has a law right now that says if you have encryption with more than a 40-bit key, which is that's a very weak key, it's against the law. So most modern communications protocols, most modern shopping on the internet violates the law in India. They're very worried about the Mumbai bombings, and so they've been pushing back against global companies here. And in the paper, we talk about how that's a problem and have a series of reasons why, within the Indian context, they should permit this kind of strong encryption that the United States went to back in the 1990s. I think even more worrisome in some ways is what's happening in China. China has a policy called the Indigenous Innovation Policy. How many people have heard of that previously? Just a few. This is a big deal in international trade. So if you are going to do business in China, and what country doesn't at some level, you are supposed to play along with this policy, which for encryption means if you build hardware, you're supposed to use their homegrown encryption approach and not the globally tested standards. It means if you sell or make software there, you're supposed to use homegrown Chinese encryption. And so it's a huge protectionist effort to build a Chinese encryption industry using their algorithms that we've never been able to test and that might have backdoors to the Chinese government. So if you want the Chinese government to have access to all the communications that come from China in terms of hardware, software originate, then you love the Indigenous Innovation Policy, and if not, you don't. So that's the overstated sort of for the Hill point there. But this indigenous innovation policy is a huge deal in trade, and it has a very strong crypto problem, and I think more people should be paying attention to it. The second topic is the area that's called CALEA, which is one of those acronyms nobody can remember what it means. It's digital wiretaps. So back in the 1990s, the FBI was very sad because they used to have wiretaps that were made with copper wire, and if you touch copper wire to copper wire, it works great. You can listen, okay? But then we switched to glass, fiber optics. Have you ever tried touching glass to glass? I mean, you don't get much, right? There's nothing at all. There's no current. They couldn't hear a thing. They went to Congress, the FBI, and Congress passed a law that said for the switch telephone network, they have to build it pre-cleared by the FBI and wiretap ready, which is a big deal for AT&T. It cost them a lot of money, big compliance and all that. And a guy named Jerry Berman and some of the people who are now at CDT were essential in the debate to create a little compromise. The compromise was we'd leave the IP network out of that. So if you're doing the IP network, which we call the internet, you don't have to pre-clear it with the FBI, and you don't have to build it wiretap ready. And that little exception grew up into the internet after 1994 we have today. So in testimony last year, the general counsel for the FBI said we need to update this, that we are going dark. And in her vision, the idea is that we are facing unprecedented problems for the internet. So I'll give you an example. How many people here have heard of the game World of Warcraft? You have teenagers or something like that? Okay. You might think of it as a video game, a game online. The FBI sees it as a global terrorist communication network. And they're not wrong at some level, right? Because I have you know, two sons, right? They play, and I try to cancel their subscription. But they play, and they have the headphone on, and they have chat going the whole time. They have global free communications by chat and by voice when they're playing WoW without the FBI having any obvious way to get into that. So for the FBI, these new technologies, they say they're going dark. They have law enforcement orders that say WoW should comply, but they might not have built it that way. So in a paper, in the encryption paper and in a separate blog post called Going Dark versus a Golden Age of Surveillance, we make the point that that going dark image is wrong. And that instead, we really should see this for the FBI, for the NSA, et cetera, as a golden age of surveillance. But they'll never say it that way, and I'll give you three reasons why. First reason is, in history of human race, we rarely carried a tracking device until now. So almost all of you have a phone, which today creates pings that can be tracked all over the place, and there's records we don't know in how much detail that are kept by wireless carriers. So now we have location of people available to the cops. Another thing we have is really good information about the Confederates, co-conspirators and friends of people. Every text, every email, every phone call you make, and you make a lot of them. And then the third thing is, if it's not enough knowing where all those people are and everybody they contact, we also have all the other databases that we've ever had. So if you compare the FBI 25 years ago to the FBI today, they have all this great stuff they never had before in granular detail. And if they had to make a choice, the laws today and the capabilities of the laws 25 years ago, they would choose the package they have today. They're not going dark. They have unprecedented stuff to do their job. So there's, you know, there's problems that face law enforcement, national security, but when you hear going dark, think instead golden age of surveillance. The third point, and I'll make it briefly, goes back to the openness of the internet, which I think our two previous speakers got to. And there was emphasis about this multi-stakeholder process. Let me try to make it concrete. There's discussion about having the UN or UN-like organizations get way deeper into running the internet. Is that basically a lot of the position? Okay. So let me just think about how this worked for the human rights area, where a few years ago, the chair country for the human rights part of the UN, as I understand it, was run by Muammar Gaddafi's Libya. What a great way to do human rights in the world. So do we want that to be the model for the internet? And the point is that there's this very complicated favor swapping, who has the votes, a set of ways the UN does stuff, and every country is its own sovereign. But when we're talking about the internet, to have the biggest internet censors with the most incentive pushing and pushing and pushing at the UN to build the internet their way, that's not a very promising path. And so when you hear multi-stakeholder and it's got too many syllables and it's sort of vague and why should we care, just think about Libya running human rights and say you're against that and say we do want this other thing, which is more bottom-up, which is more transparency, which is more consensus, which is more tech-based. And that open tech-based consensus global standards is the way to go and not Libya running the human rights organization. So those are my three points. On crypto, watch out for China, what's happening there, and the trade problems. On going dark, think golden age of surveillance. And on internet freedom, think about Libya running human rights, and we don't want that to happen to the internet.
Okay, well, that was a great variety of perspectives on this issue, and I'm going to throw a few questions myself out to the panel before we open it up to the audience. This one is, you know, we've heard about countries that clearly raise concerns like Iran, but what about countries like India and others who seem to have a core of legitimate cybersecurity concerns? How can we help them with these technology issues in a way that doesn't lead to some of the concerns that have been expressed here today?
Is there
anything that can be done to...
No, I mean, Cynthia, I think, has already touched on it. I think we have to demonstrate to them how it can be done in an internet freedom-friendly way. But, you know, they're not always so open to hearing what we have to do. The Indias, the Brazils, the South Africas retain the view that they do not want to be dominated by the West, particularly their diplomats. And so it can sometimes be challenging to get them to follow our lead. But I'm curious whether Cynthia...
I was in India last March, and I think one part could be taking a page from what happened with crypto in the late 90s, which is part of why Indian national security, Home Department, et cetera, are pushing so hard for surveillance capabilities. That part. There's a separate part about the gods and goddesses censorship. But on the surveillance part, they do not have within the government a very well-developed tech capability so far. They don't have that much capacity to handle moderately sophisticated intercepts. When the encryption change happened for the U.S. government, part of the deal was the FBI was going to get money for tech, and there was going to be a commitment over a period of years to work with private, public, and with other government agencies to keep the capacity up. And that way, the FBI would be able to do what it could do. And there's one important payoff there. Part of why India is trying to write bad laws right now is to make up for bad technology. They can't figure out how to actually do the stuff that is feasible, and so they try to pass blunderbuss laws that will just stop everybody from doing things. If they have a little more nuanced laws with a little bit better process, they'll actually get more of what they want, but they won't have to write the bad laws that wreck everybody else's internet. So capacity building, I think, is at least one thing to look at to try to reduce the temptation for bad laws.
And just to add to that, I mean, I would say that I'm more worried about the Indias and the Brazils of this world. I mean, India is the largest democracy, and their privacy laws are going in a really bad place right now. So I'm more worried about those jurisdictions than I am about the Chinas and Irans, because they are really going to be the ones that determine the future of the internet just because of their pure size and market power. But to add to what Peter just said, I mean, I think, correct me if I'm wrong since I wasn't around, but I think the crypto wars were decided.
Yeah, I'm the old guy here.
That's what I was implying. But the crypto wars were decided the right way because it was better for security, not because it was better for privacy necessarily. Yeah. And I think getting that message across also to the Indian government, I think, would be very...
You know, for instance, talking about why would anybody outsource to India if we have known broken communications is something that is worth saying.
Can I add one more point here? And that is we're trying to do this generally with these countries on human rights because there's quite a gap between their behavior internationally on human rights issues and the fact that they are, in some cases, well-established democracies domestically. And that is capacitating civil society as well in those countries, educating civil society and giving them the wherewithal to be weighing in on these issues to a greater extent than is already the case. If the political leadership of these countries feel like they're being watched and being held accountable on these issues, it's likely to produce better behavior.
Great. Cynthia, you also mentioned the importance of the legal and policy framework as a way to think about these technology issues. What are some things that folks are saying? I know we mentioned the OECD principles and other things where there are attempts to try and shape good forward-thinking policies. Just, Peter, as you were saying, you know, crypto is kind of a specific implementation. But what about it? What about the policy frameworks that
sure.
we can do?
I mean, I think that, you know, as I started out, I think in terms of dealing with these really complex policy challenges, and for a lot of governments outside the U.S., these policy challenges are brand new, right? They've never had to deal with surveillance on the Internet because they are just now getting the Internet. And I think, again, it's really a matter of returning to first principles. And I think that, lucky for us, last year was an extremely good year for Internet policymaking principles. A number of different intergovernmental organizations have developed some really great norms out there. And the two that I would highlight are the OECD Internet Policy Principles and also the UN Special Rapporteur on Freedom of Expression and Opinion, Frank LaRue, his seminal report on free expression online. Now, the OECD principles, they came from a very intense crucible of debate and discussion. I mean, some people were not happy with the way that those came out. But I think that from our perspective, read in their entirety, they really do evince a commitment to the open Internet, to the rule of law and human rights, and to multi-stakeholder governance. And as with any document of this kind, there's always going to be quibbles about words or turns of phrase, but I think they are in the right place in terms of the direction that they're going. And I guess one more note about the UN Special Rapporteur, I think that his work was really important because it was really the first document to put out a very progressive interpretation of what it means to protect free expression, what it means to ensure that Article 19 of the Universal Declaration has meaning in the digital age. And I think that there's some really good guidance in there for governments who are trying to both deal with very bad things that could happen on the Internet while also protecting human rights.
And Cynthia, maybe you could just mention a couple of the specific recommendations in there, because he really does approach it from a process standpoint, I'd say, more than kind of assuming that there are going to be different judgments in different countries, right?
Right. I mean, I think that he says, you know, human rights standards are like legal standards, and so they are an application of old language to new situations. And so he really emphasizes the need for any limitations on speech to be exceptional and also proportionate to, assessing the collateral possible damage to speech in trying to achieve the aim you're trying to achieve. And so I think he really lays out what those old standards mean for new technologies like user-generated content sites, like search engines and the like.
Peter, do you have anything?
So the question is OECD and the multi-stakeholder decisions about Internet policy frameworks. We're at a NET Caucus for the Hill event. And if you've been around Washington for a while and work on issues, you realize there's new staffers in Congress that come all the time. So if you win in 1 year and everybody understands your arguments, you come back 2 or 4 years later, there's a lot of new 20-somethings that weren't there last time, right? A couple people are cracking up because they've lived this, and it's just like, oh my. So you have to educate again. The things that you won in an earlier round, you have to win again. And I think at some level that's the message on open Internet. We had huge wins on open Internet as the Internet was taking off through the 90s. And a lot of people who've lived that get the open Internet. But now there's new countries coming in, and they're like the new staffers. They haven't lived this yet. And so there's a real education about why so many people benefit from this openness compared to the fractured and contentious and broken Internet we can get if every country starts to clamp down on stuff. And that's just a message that has to be repeated over and over again because new people come into the debate.
So we talked a little bit about the concerns about the ITU or the UN or some other intergovernmental agency exerting more control over the Internet, and then kind of multi-stakeholder as the alternative bottom-up approach. And I've been struck over the past few years how multi-stakeholder has started to become a way of thinking about things in the U.S., whether it's privacy and issues like that. But I've also heard some skepticism, security is different, and does that not apply as much on some of these core government areas of concern? So, maybe I'd ask the panelists to talk a little bit about what, you know, multi-stakeholder has been thrown around a lot, but what does it really mean in this context, and how can we, how can it be used as a way to make progress on some of these concerns in a way that's an alternative view to what we hear some countries advancing?
You want to start? No? I can say a few things, and then, and Cynthia. So I think the debate about SOPA this week and DNSSEC, that part of the debate, has woken people up to the quite remarkable improvements in security we're likely or seem to be on the verge of getting from the multi-stakeholder practices. So when it comes to the internet, here this looks like a win from multi-stakeholder and a possible problem if we write laws in one country that break it up. Okay, so that's cybersecurity winning with multi-stakeholder. So I think that's a useful point. There are many things that are government to government. In the encryption setting, I'm sorry, I've just been working on it, so I'm filled up with recent examples. There's an issue of when, let's say, somebody in India wants to get access to somebody's servers in the United States. And we have a process called MLATs, which is the multilateral treaties to help each other. That probably doesn't work very well right now. We probably need better government-to-government processes so that when there's legitimate requests, we can handle it in a time frame that makes sense. That's an area that I hope the State Department and the Justice Department can agree on and try to work out better. So there are some things that have to be government-to-government.
I mean, I guess I'll just respond to say that while I don't think anyone's pretending that multi-governance structure, multi-stakeholder governance structures are the end-all, be-all, I think that there are going to be issues that we're going to have to muddle through on. But I think most engineers will say that it has worked pretty well so far. And the question I would pose back is, well, what is the alternative? And right now, the alternative on the table is a body like the International Telecommunications Union, the ITU. And I'll give a couple reasons, three reasons, why it would be pretty problematic and pretty worrisome for the locus of internet governance to move to a body like the ITU. The ITU is a treaty body, and it's accustomed to very top-down telecom-style regulation. It's really different from the way that the internet has been governed or regulated in the past, and I am very unsure that that kind of model would be flexible enough or scalable enough to deal with the fast pace of internet technology. Second is this kind of body is particularly inaccessible to civil society, right? So it's the opposite of the multi-stakeholder open voluntary model. Civil society does not have a seat at the table. They don't really get a chance to discuss, much less participate in the decision-making process. And finally, I would say that many of the governments, if you look at the governments pressing for internet governance to move to the ITU, they have a very different vision of what the internet will look like in 10 years. And it's a vision that's not necessarily based in human rights norms. It's a vision where there is more, that gives much more due to legitimate concerns like law enforcement and the like, but also in ways that can serve as proxies for censorship and surveillance and human rights violations. And so I think for all those reasons, we should be very worried about that particular very concrete alternative that is now waving its hand on the horizon.
Can I just quickly? Yeah. Just on the – oh, sorry.
Go ahead. No, go ahead.
Just a brief point on the ITU, the International Telecommunications Union. In the early 90s – I really am the historian here. I'm sorry. In the early 90s, there was some discussion about how much the internet, as it was starting to go international, would go into the ITU. And one of the great triumphs was it didn't. And if you were waiting for anything to happen in the ITU, where you literally have to put stuff on the agenda, I've been told, more than a year out before you have a meeting, and you can't change the agenda. In a world like that, what would have happened to the internet? And so it just seems like the ITU is probably trying to find a reason for its continued existence. The people who go to those meetings would like to keep going to those meetings because they're all over the world and it's really fun. But that doesn't mean they should get to take over the internet now or that they could do it anything like the pace that needs to be happened.
Let me just play devil's advocate here for a second and give you a flavor of what we hear. I don't know whether we have representatives of embassies here in the room, but what it is we hear in the State Department when we make these arguments. Well, of course the United States is in favor of the current approach. The United States controls ICANN. The U.S. corporations essentially control the internet. U.S. civil society is by and large predominates when it comes to internet issues. Of course you're in favor of maintaining a multi-stakeholder approach because that favors the United States. We want to shift power in these institutions away from the United States to other countries that don't have the resources, that don't have the private sector, that don't have the civil society. And the only way we can do that is through the UN. That's what the UN was designed to do. And just to go back to my point, I think it's incumbent on us to prove to a lot of these governments that the multi-stakeholder approach is ultimately in their interest. I don't think it's self-evident to them that that's the case. And I think that's where we need to turn a lot of
what's been most effective, or what are some of the things the State Department says that seem to be effective in answering back to that critique?
Peter, we're just starting this debate, really. No, and I think it is to argue with our companies that ultimately to a poor country in the South, they're going to get more resources through the multi-stakeholder model than they are by trying to duke it out in New York and Geneva through the conventional UN structures.
So one argument I would try, if that is the idea of power sometimes is zero sum. If the U.S. has more power, then Brazil has less power. And there's times when that's true. I think most of us tend to think of the Internet as a wonderful example of positive sum, that there's been incredible new capabilities and growth and cool things that have happened. And that's happened. We have demonstrable happening of that for the last 20 years. And so it's not about the U.S. controlling. It's about having these amazing new capabilities that are happening in country after country. And risking that is risking a lot. It's not zero sum. It's positive sum.
Well, and how much of it is capacity building? Because in a lot of these countries, the Internet is doing tremendous things for the economy. And it may be that you have parts of the government that get understand that and parts of the government that don't, and maybe bridging the divide sometimes even within the governments. And you tend to, as Peter said, have the old school regulator sometimes driving parts of the agenda that may not fully understand this.
No, we do find that ministries of foreign affairs who are more accustomed to duking things out in the UN tend to be more conservative on these points, whereas ICT ministers and ministries understand the benefits of the Internet. So it's getting to them helping them
make the arguments
to
their colleagues. Yes. Yeah. Cynthia, and then we'll open it up to questions.
I just wanted to make one comment here. I'm Bob Borston from Google about the ITU debate. And that is, I think we've lost track of the biggest threat here. The ITU is an organization that in the past has focused on extraordinarily complex logistical things. How do you run cables? How do you connect countries? What are the standards for phone lines? Putting them into the Internet would cause them to not only do that kind of thing, but also get into the business of content regulation, also known in some quarters as censorship. And that's why I think the whole idea behind the ITU taking over the Internet and having regulatory power there is a difficult, if not dangerous, subject to be discussing.
Thank you.
Yeah, just to build on that, I mean, I think a lot of the arguments that nations that are pushing Internet governance towards the ITU are making are about security, right? We need a more coordinated approach to cybersecurity, information security, network security. But for a lot of those countries, those are very much code words for unbridled government surveillance and censorship, so just to be clear there. But just to build on Scott's point, I think for our part, one of the things that we're doing is trying to build the capacity of civil society in key markets that have a very keen interest in what happens at the ITU, but may not know actually what their governments are proposing at the ITU because it's such an opaque process. And so that's one of the things that we're doing is in terms of outreach and capacity building. Mm-hmm. And the final thing I would say is that I mean, the unfortunate truth is, again, not to bring it back to the U.S. policy debates, but our policy debates really impact the U.S. government's ability to make its case to allies at places like the ITU and to friends of the ITU. When ICE seizes domain names or our debate over SOAP and PIPA, again, that's right or wrong, being perceived by a lot of civil society is another example of American overreach in Internet governance.
I think Bob made a very important point, though, about how these what seem like arcane technical issues about routing and other things can become tools for content censorship or surveillance and other things. And, how do we work with countries who maybe are, could go either way on this issue and get them to kind of take a hands-off approach on the technology, which I think is difficult even here in the U.S.?
Well, a bunch of their governments want certain kinds of censorship, right? So India this week, it's about not enough respect for Hindu gods and goddesses, and it's one thing after another. So saying, oh, then there'll be censorship, they say, oh, then there'll be rule of law. So in their view, that doesn't necessarily convince them because they want certain capabilities. That's why I think something that's clearly in their interest, my attempt was to say positive sum and not zero sum, and we need more arguments like that, I think might be needed to keep winning that argument.
Are there any other questions from the audience?
Richard Bennett with ITIF. When we talk about internet freedom in the United States, we understand that term and that concept in terms of our American values about free expression and speech, which, believe it or not, are not the universal values that every country in the world buys into, right? So the internet's supposed to be this decentralized system where the operators of individual networks can apply their own policies. But it seems that it's, in fact, very brittle in terms of its ability to accommodate different policies in different jurisdictions. And I think what we're sort of implicitly asking for is that countries around the world have to conform their laws to what's convenient to the internet. And what's convenient to the internet was created by this multi-stakeholder process, primarily the IETF in the technical realm. But it seems that it's difficult to push back on this ITU thing if we're going to offer up the current multi-stakeholder model as some sort of fine, shining example of effectiveness. The DNS security standard took 14 years to get to the point where 0.2% of the domains on the internet are secure. I mean, and we're hearing, you know, these complaints that it can't accommodate anti-piracy. So, I mean, I think the issues here are really a lot more complex than probably you can cover in an hour-long panel.
Right. Well, I think one of the questions maybe embedded in what you're saying is, you know, and Peter, you touched on this, different countries have different views of what should be lawful or unlawful content, and are there ways to accommodate that without changing the structure of the internet? And when we say rule of law, you know, can we do that in a way that accommodates some differences here as well?
Can I actually push back on that particular statement just a little bit? Because I think that countries are not monolithic, and in many instances, governments don't rule with consent of the governed. And so I think China is the example I know best because that's my background. But I think that you'll find that the Chinese government is not particularly interested in protecting free expression, but many Chinese citizens are. And so I think that there are those equities involved as well when talking about how best to manage and govern this very global network.
Can I say, too, I mean, we do have a global consensus around the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, and Article 19 in particular there on free expression does talk about the applicability of that provision to new media. And so one of our strategies is, rather than talk about the intricacies, I have no doubt that there are going to be challenges in working out some of these technical details, but if we can resort to fundamentals that governments, including China, even if they might not abide by it in practice, have agreed to internationally, it may help our case for establishing standards in this new space at the same time.
Question.
Mark McCarthy with SIIA in Georgetown. A brief comment on the Declaration of Human Rights. It's a great document. There's a lot of signatories, but there are a substantial number of loopholes, so much so that a number of commentators have said over the years that the First Amendment on the Internet is a local ordinance. Maybe the way forward is to look at the areas where Internet freedom overlaps with other issues, with economic issues, where there is a well-developed body of law. The General Agreement on Trade and Services is out there. It's been in place since 1994. And if a country is involved in blocking access to offshore social networks or offshore microblog sites or offshore search engines, if they're saying that you can't transfer information to offshore cloud computing services, or you have to locate your services within a country, it looks as though they're engaging in a kind of protectionism, and there are well-developed ways of trying to deal with that. WTO cases is one way to go, trying to incorporate these kind of issues into regional trade agreements. What's your sense of that avenue for forward movement in the area of internet freedom?
Just as a factual matter, we have raised questions with both the Vietnamese and Chinese. I think both of these have been reported on in the context of the trade regime. We haven't filed or initiated any formal action yet, but the mere fact that we raised these questions and concerns, I think, indicates that we're prepared to leverage those regimes potentially to try and address these issues.
I also know the Department of Commerce has a free flow of information proceeding that really squarely tees up the issue the way that you've described it to say, you know, we should be thinking about this in terms of this is the commerce for the 21st century.
I think the trade angle is an important angle. You build more allies if you realize that there's blocking of trade in a protectionist way. There's some tricks here. GATS has loopholes also. The indigenous innovation document in China that I was talking about applies to people who sell to state industries. Now, in a communist country, that's a lot of people, right? But it also is government procurement. So it turns out that the defense from the Chinese side, as I understand it, is, hey, it's just government procurement. We never signed the government procurement agreements, so be quiet, even though it applies to a huge fraction of the economy. And so the trade laws are not always in place specifically on point to help in these things.
Any other questions? Well, I was going to pick up on something that Peter, you had mentioned, is we talk about double-edged swords and the golden age of surveillance. I think one of the concerns I've heard expressed in other countries is that, you know, smart governments, smart but you know, problematic governments are starting to use social networking and other tools to spy on citizens, to infiltrate and other things. Is there anything that, you know, that can be done to address some of those concerns, either technically or, you know, capacity building or other things? That seems like a growing area of concern, is that they'll get smart and instead of blocking it, they'll take advantage of it.
And then we hope the tech innovators will come up with the next round of cool stuff. I mean, I think that's been going on since the Soviet Union tried to ban typewriters if they weren't registered with the state, and there's been a series of moves since then. So that's a little flip, but, you know, I've a different writing that I think maybe you're asking about is I've got an article that'll be out this month on social networks and freedom of association, that there's this amazing power of social networks and our other tools, like the Arab Spring and the rest, to reach out and enable people to do things. On this, I just keep hoping the United States serves as a good model to the rest of the world and doesn't have our own law enforcement folks insist on things that we would not put up with in the rest of the world. If we're the model for surveillance, if we build the equipment and we build the laws for surveillance, other countries have a lot more room to do it as well.
And I might say something slightly controversial, which is that, you know, to Mark's point as well, you know, the U.S. government has a number of tools in its arsenal, including aid policy as well, right? And so there's been a lot of really fantastic development work where we've helped countries build their ICT systems, but then we've neglected the policy framework around those systems, right? So we help build a mobile system, but we don't talk about what are the legal protections that should be in place to counterbalance privacy and surveillance. It's a little controversial among certain circles, but another idea to put out.
No, it's one of the things that we're considering, and indeed the Millennium Challenge Corporation recently had a revamping of its criteria for making decisions about which countries it would provide assistance, and one of the additions they're making is to look at internet freedom among the various human rights criteria that it applies.
Well, Scott, you can have the last word. I think, as Richard said, we could go on about this subject for a lot longer, but there's going to be a cocktail reception so we can continue the discussion out there, and also a reminder that State of the Net continues tomorrow, and there are going to be more good panels and discussions on spectrum and entertainment in the cloud and other things. So please come back tomorrow. And thanks again. Please give my panelists a round of applause.